there, fuckers. It's me, Holden McNeely, and this chunky boy is Jake Young.
May the force be with ye.
Jake, for the love of God. And we're here to tell you about The Wizard and the Bruiser, a podcast that uncovers the truth behind how your favorite superheroes, anime series, and video games became the pop culture juggernauts that we rely on to forget the pain of existence.
We're not saying that this is the most informative geek history podcast ever, but I will promise you that you will learn enough to impress your one really weird cousin who always wears the Naruto headband.
And if you are that weird cousin, let me just say, arigato, otaku senpai. How was that, Jake?
Acceptably racist.
Hop on the way, way back machine as we take you to 1992 when Mortal Kombat ruled the arcades and kids were clamoring for the newest issue of Spawn.
Or just sit back and relax as two aging comedians try to understand how the hell Minecraft managed to conquer the minds of our nation's chubbiest children.
No matter what, we'll do our damnedest to make sure every episode is an unforgettable journey through the stories you love, hate, or maybe just don't understand yet.
Check out Wizard and the Bruiser on the Last Podcast Network. It's geek history with extra bits.
There's no place to escape to.
This is the last podcast
on the left.
Rise from your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
So, I don't know what is worse. Honestly, we're going through the atrocious crimes of Josef Mengele, as I've heard several documentaries.
Oh, I don't know if that's right.
But unfortunately, since the very beginning, and I don't know why this happened, but in my brain started playing every single time I saw Mengele was this tune. Mangala,
that's horrible. All right, this is the last podcast on the left. I am Ben Kissel with Marcus Parks, with the guy who always has music in his head, Henry Zebrowski, as well.
That's a good way of putting it.
I'm not a monster. I don't know. I'm not. I wasn't born a monster.
So
I think I've just become like this.
On today's episode and the next couple of episodes, we're covering a dude. He is maybe. Perhaps the worst person in the world. One of them, top five. We'll give him top five. We're going to talk about Josef Mengele, and it is going to be hard to deal with at some parts, but we're going to get you the information you need to know.
Mengele.
Right, the
cockroach. He's not a bad person.
What?
Henry!
Jesus! We're already off to a very controversial start. Please don't isolate that. And this is like the rock opera? It's a rock opera.
I don't want it to be like this.
I don't know.
My brain copes. It's how my brain does. It allows it to survive.
Well, I watched quite a few documentaries, and I understand it is difficult to get through. You gotta find some coping mechanism, because what we're going to talk about is obviously extremely dark and extremely morbid, and in many ways, of course, in all ways, extremely sad.
Mm-hmm. Well, Josef Mengele, aka the Angel of Death, was a Nazi SS officer who oversaw the cruelest and most useless human experiments in Auschwitz, the most infamous and brutal of all Nazi concentration camps. Mengele was personally responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands, not only through being one of the main selectors who decided who lived and who would be sent immediately to the gas chambers upon the arrival to Auschwitz, but also through the torturing and killing of thousands, mostly children, just to see what would happen.
Just to see what would happen. It that is the element here that is the scariest, of course. And
right.
If we look at Josef Mengele, I think this is, in a way, this is a heavy hitter. But it's a heavy hitter. It's a serial killer who got a job to be a serial killer with a government that is entirely filled with serial killers. So it's that. It's the Mengele is the extension of the long, horrible arm of the Nazis and what it would do to a bunch of innocent people.
Right, of course. I mean, it's sad when obviously the outcome of like what's going to happen, they're going to die.
Yeah.
I would just like to tell them that so that maybe you don't have to do all of this crap.
Well, part of the point was that they would die, because a lot of times the biggest point was to kill them to see what the experiments had done to their organs. And that was why they were so excited to be working in this environment, because they, for the first time in human history, were completely unfettered from any sort of morality whatsoever.
perfect storm.
And I don't know why this surprised me so much, but Mengele was doing all of this starting at the horrifyingly young age of 32.
We're going to get into his backstory a little bit here, right?
Very much
so.
That's
the idea.
It does seem very bizarre that you would just snap your brain at the age of 32 and decide that this is the road to go down as a doctor.
It's it is a slow progression, but at the same time, like it makes sense and doesn't make sense all at the same time. But we'll get into it.
Yeah, you'll see, Kissel. You'll learn how someone can go from being a normal, Hummel-dressed Bavarian youth to being the angel of death of Auschwitz.
I understand. Makes sense, but also doesn't make sense. You know what else doesn't make sense, but also makes sense? Schnitzel.
What are you talking about? Schnitzel?
Nothing makes sense about schnitzel.
No.
I thought it was
Kissel,
a sausage-based food until I was about 25, and I'm half German. Kissel, I did not realize it was pounded down. Only the Germans could take
mostly German. There's literally nothing wrong with schnitzel. It's absolutely delicious. It is the German version of fucking chicken parmesan.
Is it a chicken cutlet?
Are you downing this? I have never been so offended.
It really is.
So
it makes no
upset
sense.
Upset by a thing that you said.
Just call it a chicken cutlet, but what is it? It's not even made of chicken.
You know, it's made out of veal,
which
I don't necessarily eat anymore, but at the same time, it's delicious.
God. I just realized the schnitzel is the most German thing of all time. It's a baby calf that has been tortured its entire life, and then they beat it, and they pound it, and then they deep fry it.
Well, Mengele was what you would call the perfect Nazi.
Ugh.
He took orders without question. He believed wholeheartedly in the mission of Adolf Hitler. He was a virulent anti-Semite, and all of his tasks were done with a ghoulish, almost unbelievable delight.
And that's the thing that sets him apart even from the worst of the worst that he was working with at Auschwitz, is the fact that they said he did everything with a smile on his face.
If we have to do when you have to name the celebrity by their smile, Mengele's smile versus Ed Gein. Who's got the more like something's wrong upstairs smile?
Well, Ed Gein was kind of just a simple farm boy who got too curious for his own good.
Yeah.
He was sick as well. He was very, very sick.
Right.
Mengele was not sick.
He was sick. The entire country got sick. That's how I sort of view it almost. It was like
a mental
fucking illness. Germany went insane for fucking 13 years, and this is what came out of it.
Right.
Also, Mengele's smile was part of the reason why he was even recognized by some of his workers when he had fled to Argentina. So it's interesting you brought up his smile, Kissel.
Well, Mengele had a very distinctive smile because he had a huge gap between his front teeth.
Oh, okay.
However, to be the perfect Nazi is to be somewhat dull, because Joseph Mengele was a flavorless shell devoid of humanity with all the personality of a reptile.
Right.
But you'd think, considering what he did, his past would be a nightmare comparable to the worst of serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
But surprisingly, the history of Mengele prior to Auschwitz is not much different than any other SS officer.
Jeez.
In fact, to this day, we're still not sure what Joseph Mengele's exact motivations were.
I think it was Marlboro points.
Well, honestly, man, I know people who literally died of cancer 15 years ago, but they still have an inflatable raft. And that lasts a lifetime.
My dad's dream was the canoe, and he couldn't even fit into a goddamn canoe.
Marlboro Miles is one of the most, one of the worst marketing schemes in the history of marketing.
But the fact that Mengele is not much different from any other SS officer is precisely why this is a fascinating story, because the story of Mengele runs side by side with thousands of other doctors who collectively lost their minds over a period of a few decades. Mm. Now, this is not the story of how Germany came under the spell of Hitler. This is the story of how thousands of doctors took advantage of that spell to commit acts of cruelty beyond what anyone thought possible. It just so happens that Mengele was the worst of them.
Honestly, in the middle of this, I finally did. It's the first time I went to the doctor in a couple of years, and so I went to the doctor, and the whole time I'm just being like, doctors, you can't trust fucking doctors.
You can't. Oh my God.
The way they were pushing that flu vaccine, it does get to a point being like, is the mark of the beast in that? Is the RFID chip in that?
Hey man, I was at my therapist this past week here around Thursday or whatever, and he just called me fat a bunch, and then he told me I had to go to the doctor, and then this is not the time to be talking about that kind of stuff.
No, you know, your diet is very directly related to mental health.
Yeah, I know. That's what he said. No, he said your organs might be all messed up, and I'm like, what? They're fine. They're all in there. But that's interesting you say spell. Joe Mackey, he's a very funny comedian, but he talks about Hitler convincing everyone blue eyes and blonde hair is the way to be when he has dark eyes and dark hair. And that just shows you the power of this, what was going on there.
Yeah. Now, some say that Mengele was driven by pure academic ambition, that he used the human being sent to Auschwitz to advance his own career using resources, i.e. living human beings, that nobody in history had ever had access to. Now, others say that Mengele was just playing at being a scientist, that he was a pure psychopath who just enjoyed playing God, cataloging his quote-unquote research and collecting rare specimens, whether it be an interesting gallstone or a whole family of dwarves, just because he could.
Kind of sort of like the way Michael Jackson curated his ranch, the Neverland Ranch.
Yeah, I guess so, in a way.
Yeah, Michael Jackson just got monkeys.
He got the Elephant Man.
Tigers.
He got the Elephant Man bones.
He did buy Joseph Merrick's bones.
Yeah.
He did. And also, I mean, I'm not going to not say he didn't have a couple of dwarves just hanging around, only just so that he could dress them up as children so that they could talk to the children and be like, it's not so bad, kid, once you get used to it.
Oh my goodness. A union rep, huh? Well, that's not good. Things are going the wrong direction there.
But whatever Mengele really was, I do think that one of the observations I read during our research is true. In any other time, Mengele would have been nothing more than a slightly sadistic German professor. He wouldn't have been a serial killer.
Jeez.
It's interesting because I think there's a combination to all of this, especially, I mean, this is going to be an ongoing conversation we're going to have as we go through his crimes and they do the deep dive behind his rise and shit like that. But a part of it is, I don't even know anymore. Like, once you get into his life in Auschwitz, which I think you put correctly, it's like he came online, as in when he got to Auschwitz, he became the thing that technically fate was bringing him towards to be this monster. But, I mean, even as a sadistic German professor with the shit that he did, I would not want to be his TA.
No, that's for sure. I have no idea. It would be interesting to know if he went down, like, the Peter Curtin route or something at some point.
I don't think
so. Did Peter Curtin end up killing people a little bit later in life as well?
A little bit, but I really don't think that Mengele would have done what... I don't think he would have just kidnapped children off of the street and tried to sew them together to see what would happen.
I'm just going
to
say this right now. I'm not going to give him the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to do it.
Well, that's the thing, is that, like, Nazi Germany, and particularly Auschwitz, activated something in Mengele and hundreds of other SS officers. Mm. But in slight contrast, Mengele was the only one who didn't really seem bothered by the whole operation. I mean, we're going to get into it fully on the second episode, but there isn't going to be any myth-busting here. Auschwitz really does deserve its reputation as the worst place in human history that we know of.
Just thinking about the bunker that Mengele worked out of, which we'll talk about, and the idea of, like, where are there other places in this world where more evil energy is centered besides, I mean, where Unit 731 was started, the Cece's Pizza in Tallahassee.
Yeah, something about this time period. People were really... I guess medically curious in all the wrong ways.
Yeah.
It is interesting. It's like when you go to, have you ever been to a paper mill town?
Yeah. It smells like farts.
It smells like farts. Eggs. And you go there and then you look at everyone in the face and you're like, smells. Like, you just want them to recognize it smells, but they don't know that it smells. And you're like, it definitely smells.
There was an article, I forget what book we were going to. I want to say it was when we were doing Mark Twitchell, because they said that one of the other Canadian towns around it was a paper mill. And what they said is that it doesn't smell like farts, it smells like money.
That also sounds like the weirdest porn producer in L.A. That's not a fart. That is money.
He's just him wiping cum off a black couch and eating it. Like, it tastes like money. But a part of it, honestly, but deep within, not your ignorant point, Kissel, there is a bit of truth in that, which is the idea of people getting used to something.
Of course.
At one point.
That's what I'm saying, Henry.
Would consider being human. Wow, you're like a Mark Twain.
Well, the thing about Mengele that really set him apart is that he literally whistled his way through Auschwitz.
Ugh.
Like, that was what they said about him, is that he would constantly be whistling either Wagner, of course, or Puccini. That's how people came to dread hearing whistling, because they knew that's when Mengele was coming.
Good God.
His behavior in Auschwitz was at the same time baffling and completely unknowable. In fact, I would like to quote one of the Jewish doctors who was forced to work in the camp. He said, "The professor would like to understand what is not understandable. We ourselves who were there and who have always asked ourselves the question and will ask it until the end of our lives, we will never understand it because it cannot be understood."
I've been talking about it with Natalie for the last couple of days, obviously, going through all of this material. And a part of it is that I feel like the more I read about the Nazis, it's true, the less I understand. The more I'm at this sort of very intense intersection of just going like, why did it get like this? Why it get like this? And then you can kind of see, I mean, obviously I know that there are historical reasons why, and there are the things that led up to it, but it's just more of being like, wow, they all just really let themselves throw this id-driven, hate-filled temper tantrum that they were all a part of in one go.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I was in Uruguay with my grandmother, I was able to record about 7 hours worth of conversations, and we did talk about this stuff, and there is no explanation other than it was simply the culture, and they just didn't want to be the ones who were going to be tormented. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be, you know, they knew that they had to be, in order to stay safe, they had to go along and do these things. And then also, you don't have technology. So they didn't know, they knew shit was going on.
Yeah.
They knew about all of the ghettos and stuff like that. They knew people were being killed. They knew Jewish businesses were being destroyed. But there was a lot of willful ignorance when it comes to this stuff.
Now, although Mengele's life prior to Auschwitz contains no keys to unlocking the mystery of Mengele, his individual journey, while not as detailed as many of our overviews, is still important to understanding how Germany got to Auschwitz. But before we begin, let's acknowledge our sources. We got Mengele, The Whole Story by Gerald Posner, The Nazi Doctors by Robert J. Lifton, which is dense but fucking fascinating. It's about the psychology of these guys.
All right.
You got Auschwitz by Miklos Nyizli. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce that.
I think you nailed it. Without a doubt, that's how you pronounce it.
He was Mengele's assistant and wrote a memoir after being released.
Okay, so he got away, like, they're like, oh, you were just the assistant, like,
he had no choice whatsoever.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people that were chosen specifically because they were doctors to get pulled out of the lineup in order to help.
He was a pathologist, so he worked on dissections.
Oh, all right.
We also have to cite the British documentary series Science and the Swastika.
I will say, you know what's really relieving in all of this research is that, unfortunately, I watched quite a bit of stuff with Wendy, and Wendy really does not react well to Hitler speeches. I mean it. She would literally go like, like she'd make these like weird noises and stuff. And I'm so glad it wasn't her just like wagging her tail and like doing a little zigzag.
So, without further ado, let's get into the story of Josef Mengele, and by extension, the story of Auschwitz itself. Josef Mengele was born on March 16th, 1911, the first of three sons born to Karl and Walburga Mengele.
Her hamburgers are horrible. Worst food we ever had was at the Boston airport at the Walburgers. We got it for free.
We got it for free.
It was so bad.
It was that bad. But yes, his mother's name was Walburga.
Which is actually how they pronounce it, the Walburgs.
Yeah.
Walburga.
Walburga.
Now, the family were strict Catholics, and Mengele, even when he became a Nazi, and this somewhat sets him apart as well, he still listed himself as Catholic rather than writing the stock Nazi answer of believer in God.
God, he's so brave. He's so brave.
Didn't the Nazis, my understanding is they didn't particularly care for the Catholics.
No. Well, the Catholics also somewhat, the Catholics let a lot of shit slide.
Okay.
Yeah, because they also helped a bunch of Nazis get out of Germany to get into South America, which we'll talk about it too. With Josef Mengele, I think it's interesting because we were talking about this before the show, and it's true. Every one of the documentarians I saw said the same thing. It's like, Josef Mengele, handsome, dashing, charming, funny with the ladies, sexy, sharp as a tack. He had to be.
Yeah.
The envy of men everywhere. And then I'm looking at Josef Mengele, and I'm like, he looks like Ricky Ricardo.
I was attracted back then. Yeah, I watched a documentary, and the woman, she was a survivor, but she describes him dressed perfect, beautiful shoes, stoic face. I was like, this is a man's a monster.
You see that a lot.
It's very weird.
I mean,
it's
because
they
it
want
lot.
Them to look like hook faced hunchback monsters. Yeah. You see him being like, yeah, hello. But then when you meet Josef Mengele, and he's like, you got some splaining to do,
right.
And everyone just thinks he's funny and cute because he's playing with the fucking bongos and shit.
Right. Yeah. I want Richard Chase is as attractive as I want my serial killers to be. That's it. You got to look weird.
Well, I think Henry makes a very good point, is that they do expect them to look the way on the outside that they are on the inside. And when that doesn't match up, when those two things don't match up at all, it's jarring and people remember it. Like, you definitely remember that sort of thing.
Right.
Now, the Mengele family lived in the Bavarian town of Günzburg, where they eventually founded a farm equipment company that was so successful that the Mengeles essentially ran the town.
I did a bit of a Google street walk of Günzburg.
Oh.
I went through, I looked up, the town center, and I literally walked through the streets, and it's very small, very cute, looks like a little Hummel town. And you know that Günzburg, it's got a thriving downtown shopping area. And it has one of the top 5 Legoland theme parks in Germany.
No shit.
Things have changed.
But again, it is this cute little place that everybody, you know, idyllic, looks like a fucking postcard that you go visit your opa, you know what I mean, and go skiing on the weekends. But it's like, it's got the type of racism that it's like if you go to a little vacation town where it's like, you know, maybe the KKK is in the forest. But instead of maybe it being the KKK, it's the KKK, but they believe they are descended from the wizards of white people that are from down deep inside the centers of mountains and shit.
Right.
It's very scary.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, they also had Playmobil, which is a toy very popular in Germany that I played with as a child, and none of my friends would play with me because they are very, very bland. They really are the most bland toys of all time.
Well, speaking of the Mengele's farm equipment company, to this day, you can actually buy new tractors and plows with the name Mengele plastered on the side. Although the family rebranded themselves as Mengele and Sons in the 80s.
The sons are the problem. What do you mean, Mengele and Sons? How does that make it better? Your oldest son is Josef Mengele.
The other two sons were technically not part of the problem. They just did a lot of blah, 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 blah. They were very proud of
Josef.
Then
it's Mengele and 2/3 of our sons.
Hey, old dames here. My name is Karl Mengele, and people say I'm crazy for slashing the prices on all of these tractors. And AP would say I'm crazy for slashing these prices. But I tell you what I'm crazy for. The belief sense of real energy inside of me powers me to overcome to Huden.
All right, let's take the ad back. I think we'll get it one more time here.
But tellingly, Mengele and Sons has no internet presence whatsoever. There's
what?
No Mengele.com.
So are they still in business? They're the John Deere of this part of Germany?
I only know that they still make Mengele tractors and trailers because I found a used farming equipment site selling a 2009 Mengele Silo Bull 8000 for $28,000.
I'm just going to say rebrand. Rebrand it a little bit.
But Mengele was known as the highest quality farm equipment around. Mengele, you're right. Mengele was the John Deere.
Just call it Johnson's.
Anything
whatever.
Else.
Now, as we said earlier, Josef Mengele's childhood was completely normal, although being the eldest son of the family who ran the whole goddamn town probably had an effect on his sense of superiority.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
The weirdest thing about his childhood was just that his nickname was Beppo.
Beppo?
Beppo.
Yeah.
Beppo?
Beppo.
He got cut out of the Stooges.
What happened? Is he a mime?
Yeah, no, there were accidents, but none that would point towards mass murder.
No, you just took over Beppo. How the hell do you get a nickname Beppo? What do you have to do in elementary school to get nicknamed Beppo?
Josef, the whole story didn't go into why he was called Beppo. It just said that his childhood nickname was Beppo.
You just like tiny hats and cigars that blow up?
I mean, honestly, if you would be much more excited about the name Beppo if he was a young man trying to get it onto the Notre Dame football team. And he was a rag boy and everybody just thought he could work hard enough to get on the team. But when it's one of the orchestrators of the worst crimes against humanity of all time, Beppo takes a different color.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, Beppo, I think, was Superman's monkey.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, there's Beppo the super monkey, Comet the super horse, Streaky the super cat.
We get it, Superman. Everything is super. Understood. Thank you.
The only kinds of accidents that Josef Mengele had, because that's what we always look for when we're talking about these psychopaths. We look for childhood incidents, mostly head injuries.
Right.
What he had, he almost drowned in a rainwater barrel on one occasion, and he almost died of blood poisoning on another.
Rainwater barrel?
Yeah. You fall headfirst.
Just hanging out in a rainwater barrel?
Yeah, kids are playing. You fall headfirst into a rainwater barrel. Next thing you know, you're dead.
They live the fun, the quiet lives of white people on top.
I guess so.
Now, although, you know, these are traumatic events, apparently, like, childhood blood poisoning, sepsis is one of the worst things kids can go through. Like, it definitely results in PTSD for some.
Okay.
I mean, they don't really seem bad enough to completely flip the switch on compassion
Nope. So
completely so as to explain Josef Mengele's later actions.
Right.
Now, Mengele always had an interest in medicine and biology, but his first choice of career was not doctor. Hoping to fill a profession that had no presence in Gunzburg, Mengele originally wanted to be a dentist.
Oh, it's so scary. Yeah.
So scary.
What child grows up in 1920 and is just like, I want to work with teeth? Like, that is so scary.
Yes, I want to see the talons that come out of the skull. I want to scrape them with my hook.
Especially the old school German teeth, just the dirt and the grime.
But Mengele's ambition eventually won out, as it was said that he was highly competitive with his two younger brothers. In fact, he once told a friend that he would one day read the name Josef Mengele in the encyclopedia.
Wow.
He could have been known as the man who fixed Britain's teeth, or like the dude who figured out you can cap your teeth with gold. But instead, obviously...
So, he decided instead to study general medicine, emphasizing on anthropology and human genetics, which was a decision that would have an effect on hundreds of thousands of lives. In 1930, Mengele traveled to Munich to begin his studies at Munich University. It just so happened that Munich was exactly where Adolf Hitler was consolidating power for his eventual takeover of the German government.
I do believe that Mengele's father was an early supporter of Adolf Hitler, and that they had connections, because there are pictures of them hanging out up until then, and it seems to be that the Munich connection was a little bit on purpose, that Mengele wanted to go to the center of the action.
Right.
And so once he got there, because the entire town had Hitler fever.
Hitler fever. Yeah. I mean, he was a populist and, you know, grew it. It took a little time.
Well, actually, Mengele said that when he first got there in 1930, he was like, I just want to study. I don't want to get into all this political stuff.
Hey, Mengele, this is you from the future. You're going to fucking love it.
Really?
Yeah,
you got some explaining to do, future me.
See, by 1930, the beer hall Putsch, in which Hitler and the earliest Nazis attempted to overthrow the German government, that was 8 years in the past. Right. Hitler had already done his time in prison and had become a global figure in the time since, with both his highly publicized treason trial and the publication of his manifesto, Mein Kampf. However, Mengele did not immediately join the Nazi party, as he wouldn't become an official party member until 1936. His father, on the other hand, like Henry alluded to, recognized that there was quite a bit of money to be made following this Hitler fellow, so he officially joined the Nazi party in 1931. Karl Mengele even hosted a Hitler rally, giving a platform for a speech on farming held at the Mengele factory.
It's like Iowa. It's like the Iowa State
it's
Fair.
Like the Iowa caucuses. Yeah.
Yeah, I love
it. Yeah. But then a neighboring town, there seems to be a young Heinrich Kissel, like wondering where Hitler's attention would be on their new Bierstein helmets that they were creating.
Bierstein, I mean.
We have come up with, no, Mr. Hitler, please come. Please sponsor us. We've come up with a new way of combining a light beer with a citrus fruit called a lime. That is almost impossible to drink.
Germans are a cold, mean people in many ways, but you give me a good, fat, drunk German, you're going to have a good time. That's for sure. So did Mengele Because they were in farming equipment, did they get a contract with the government at all?
Yep, because Karl Mengele was so cozy with Hitler from the beginning, Mengele and Sons essentially became the official farm equipment of the Third Reich. And what this tells us is that Mengele's anti-Semitism didn't just suddenly appear with the Nazi Party. And by extension, anti-Semitism was not something that Hitler and the Nazis created in Germany. And this is a big part of the whole how did it happen type of conversations. Because I think a lot of people think that before, like, 1933, there weren't a whole lot of anti-Semites in Germany. And all of a sudden, Hitler put this big spell on everyone. No, these people were primed and ready. The belief that the Jewish people were less than and deserving of spite already existed within Europe. In fact, when the Nazis invaded Poland, there were plenty of Poles that welcomed them based completely on their anti-Semitic beliefs.
There are also plenty of Poles that were very, very surprised to see them coming down the street because, again, they were walking backwards. It's the whole fucking thing. Man. There are plenty of Poles that did not enjoy them coming in there because they were trying to save the recipe for ice. Can we just teach? How many do I have to do?
Wow. Well, obviously, he normalized it, right?
Yeah.
So then they're like, oh, now we can express it. It was a slippery slope. Not at all like this analogy I'm about to give, but I do want to say it. They put cheese in the crust of pizza.
Uh-huh.
And now I'm on Instagram, and I see they're doing garlic knots.
Uh-huh.
The crust. And
so
it started with cheese, and if I had went back in time, and I'm complicit because I worked at Pizza Hut, and I put string cheese in the crust, I wouldn't do it anymore.
Do you see how that this is a modern equivalent to your family? About how you were a part of the industry that normalized this stuff. The family was a part of it, and now you're seeing the horrible fruits that come to bear, and you have to wonder, why did I put so much cheese inside those crusts
I should have told my 16-year-old self to tell my manager at Pizza Hut, this is more immoral and wrong. I saw another pizza that was half a calzone.
It's exactly the same. I think it's a really appropriate metaphor. The more I think about it, the more it makes sense.
It is somewhat appropriate, I guess.
It's about cheese.
I mean, it is about the slow walk. You know, it's about the slow walk, and it's about how people were primed and ready for this shit. And it was just that Hitler came and the Nazis came and it normalized it and it made it okay to be completely open about all this shit.
Obviously, people have also written books about this shit. There's a lot of information past what we're going into here. We're just trying to get back to the current time period with Mengele and see what the fuck, like, how did all this shit happen?
Oh, yeah. There's plenty of information out there.
Oh, yeah. And many of the Nazis, and Mengele especially, eventually came to justify that anti-Semitism with pseudoscience, specifically using the study of what is known as eugenics. Conceptualized by Charles Darwin's half-cousin in 1883, eugenics is pretty much the selective breeding of the human race in order to produce the so-called highest quality of offspring.
Yes.
Essentially, it's treating people like animals. It's treating them like breeding stock. It's breeding stock, whether that person be Nazi, Slav, Jewish, or somewhere in between.
This philosophy is still prevalent today. Lonzo Ball's dad, what's his name? LeVar Ball, I think. He literally just talks about breeding the kids like stock.
Weird.
And he talks, like, if you read the interviews with him and watch him, he's like, Jesus. And also Frank Thomas, he's pushing these pills called Nugenics. And every time I see it, they're literally called Nugenics.
Weird.
And so I'm like, it's a little creepy.
He just didn't know. He is not looking into the history books to reflect on his new supplement name.
I know, big hurt. A little strange, though.
Surprisingly, though, Germany was not the first place that eugenics took hold. We here in the United States were actually the first country to put eugenics into practice.
USA. USA.
When do we cheer? USA. United States of America.
Starting in 1907, we sterilized thousands of criminals, mental patients, and alcoholics, all in the name of eugenics.
I mean,
that eliminates a couple of us, doesn't it?
It's for the alcoholics. I mean, if you're drunk, be like, well, I don't got to worry about it anymore.
No, the whole thing began in Indiana, with 29 other states following suit with sterilization programs of their own over the following 30 to 60 years.
Jeez.
Eventually, California would lead the way, sterilizing more people than every other state combined.
Wow.
And honestly, I don't want to malign. Again, I said the word malign, have a drink. they are weak people.
Well, I will say the one thing California definitely propagates is the use of tight pants. So I feel like that could be it. That's a part of it. It continues to this day.
Maybe
where now I'm trying to go more athleisure. I'm trying to wear softer pants so my sperm can get bigger and thicker.
Oh, nice. Is that what you're working on right now?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right.
Oh, man, I wear briefs every day, and I wear, like, thick pants. My sperm, A-OK.
That's great. I just wrapped rubber
bands. Got them tested. They are swimming.
You got them
friend.
Tested?
Yeah.
What do you take an ACT or SAT? You give them a little pencil?
They ran him through the sprint competition that they do with the NFL at the beginning of the year, like the training camp. Just him coming on a fucking the front of a big marathon.
Just a bunch of people throwing ones down, betting on him.
And this eugenics thing, it was not just a far right-wing belief, although it was first embraced totally in 1894 by something called the Immigration Restriction League, which sought to prevent the dilution of American racial stock. Hmm. But everyone from the Rockefellers to W.E.B. Du Bois to the founder of the NAACP held eugenic beliefs to some degree. Hell, even J.H. Kellogg, the breakfast cereal guy that was obsessed with masturbation, he was fully behind eugenics.
What are you talking about? Me from college? That was me.
Really?
The breakfast cereal guy obsessed with masturbation? Yeah. That's what you were known as?
That's me.
Kellogg's guy is obsessed with masturbation?
Oh, yeah. Dude, the Kellogg, J.H. Kellogg has a hell of a history.
Really?
Yeah, part of this whole thing is like, eat cornflakes so you won't masturbate so much.
So you won't masturbate?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll tell you what. They seem to pair really well, like a red wine and a steak.
But in Nazi culture, eugenics had an extra kick.
Always, man.
The so-called science was paired with the Nazis' occult beliefs, particularly those put forth by Madame Helena Blavatsky, who is probably second only to Aleister Crowley when it comes to mentions on this show.
Right.
This is important to remember, is that a bunch of silly shit led to the worst crimes in humankind. Like, we'll go into right now. Marcus, you do the dance.
Yeah. I mean, to give a refresher, like, Madame Blavatsky wrote in her 1888 book, The Secret Doctrine, about the seven root races of mankind. Among them were the Hyperboreans, the Lemurians. Remember we did a whole episode on the Lemurians?
I remember this, yes.
A whole episode on that goofy bullshit. And the Atlanteans, like from Atlantis, Atlanteans.
Guilty
and space Jews. But we didn't, he doesn't go into the space Jews into this one. There are other people that leapfrog from Blavatsky to space Jews, but they decided to leave them out of the conversation for Nazi purposes.
That's right. And that's Madame Blavatsky saying that word, those words together, not Henry.
No, it isn't. It's Henry.
Oh.
I mean, it's the way I'm paraphrasing.
I see.
I can't go into the whole, like, going through the tetrahedron stone, different time portals and how they've been here since the beginning of creation. I can't get into that speech because this isn't a bus stop.
The race of hope, though, according to Blavatsky, were the Aryans. Mm. And you can go listen to our Nazi occult series for a full breakdown of just how goofy all the Nazi beliefs really were. I mean, that's what it is here. The Aryans, all of this Nazi, it was paired with Atlantis and all kinds of other stupid, goofy bullshit.
Well, now we're getting excessive with the calling Atlantis stupid because it actually sounds really nice.
It is like, so, I mean, this is nerd culture taken to the extreme.
It's what we talked about in the occult episode, the Nazi occult episode, is that these are white people nerds.
Right.
That's what they were nerds about.
And if you ruin Thor for me, I'm going to be really pissed off.
They already did.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if it has a white person in it, it's been ruined. Yeah.
Anything with runes.
Yeah.
Runes have been ruined by these fucking people.
But those beliefs had very real consequences. And it was the doctors, the actual scientists, who truly applied the beliefs of the Nazis to horrific purpose. They were the ones who brought it into the real world, whether they believed in all the Atlantis bullshit or not.
Right.
In fact, as Robert J. Lifton wrote in The Nazi Doctors, again, highly recommended, it was partly this romanticism that attracted eugenicists to National Socialism. See, according to Hitler in Mein Kampf, this was a marathon, not a sprint. The doctors who were to participate in the Nazi eugenics programs were going to be the creators of the Nazi race. And this project was estimated to take up to 600 years to fully realize. So this was an almost mythical effort.
Now, you could see the way they sold it, right? because how exciting would it be to be a part of a 600-year program that would slowly allow its tentacles to take over the entire world? And not only are you are engineering the people that are going to be those tentacles, the people that are going to take over everything, but they look just like you.
Yep.
They are just like you.
Right.
You are the perfect example of them. You have become God. You're building them in your image. And I, this is a part of what I think is interesting. And I think it's a question we'll bring up again, obviously, in the second episode. But I think that them applying science to it in a way, right? In the beginning, it was them prepping to win the whole thing.
Yeah.
Right? Is that it was prepping, like, this is before World War II, but they knew that they were going to be making some move at some point, right? And so it's almost like they were building the case then to show that when they won, they can be like, look, we were right. This is all our science to show we were right.
Right.
This is the validation behind all of it, because for some reason, deep in our German brain, we need all of fucking the facts to match up to show that we can do these fucking horrible things in the name of science.
They need the documents. Can you imagine if they came back and saw the Hitler youth of today looking like Target employees out of a job?
They would just never be like, can you cut it? Those
never.
Fucking piece of shit alt-right people who want to talk. Hitler, you would be the first against the fucking wall.
But about these doctors, on the other hand, one thing I read again and again was that many of these scientists were not really Nazis in the sense that, say, like Heinrich Himmler was a Nazi, like full
on. He was like a capital N-A-Z-I Nazi.
Yeah, like full on Thule Society Nazi.
Right.
It was just that the Nazis allowed these guys to believe and do reprehensible shit. So therefore, they became Nazis.
Right.
They also, a lot of times, didn't have a choice. And then didn't have a choice, and then it was either one. It's either, well, we either make a bunch of money and get really popular and become a part of the top of the social hierarchy within Germany, number one. You also get total access. You're treated like a rock star. So it's either that, or I get beat to death by a group of Nazis in the street. What do I choose? Oh, I choose the path of least resistance.
And the thing was that it was the scientists who made the Nazis legitimate. In fact, Hitler said that the medical profession was more important to the Nazi regime than any other. I mean, goofy occult belief was one thing, but if you had a doctor delivering it folded into science,
right,
then it held more weight.
And these, I mean, as opposed to a lot of people on the right now who don't believe in science at all.
Yeah. I mean, these guys were like, and Hitler's like, science is essential to all of this. This
right.
cannot happen because, you know, Hitler got all of his stupid beliefs from, you know, Madame Helena Blavatsky, a
right.
magazine called, what was it called? Estora or something like that.
Yes.
Like,
that's
it was
right.
coming from all these, like, goofy fucking places. But Hitler knew, it's like, if we want people to really believe this shit, we have to deliver it in science. And they
right.
delivered it, I mean, in the propaganda films just, like, came out over and over again. Pamphlets, leaflets, all kinds of shit. And they packaged all of it in what was seemingly a rational way.
You can almost see an inner insecurity of the validity of their own ideas, where Hitler knew also, and the only way to because that's what he was saying, right, is that he believed, oh, this gives it validity, we're going to show the whole world how powerful the Aryan race is. But he also knows that the idea is going to be so unpopular. I think in the beginning, it's almost like people will give in to the power of our race, but eventually realize, be like, no, not only do I have to eradicate everybody else in order for this idea to work, is that I have to even create within the quote unquote Aryan race a more pure, rarefied strain of the Aryan race using science. And that basically he's like, we have to reboot the entire world in my vision in order for even work, because it would splinter apart. So essentially, because people have minds and they're going to understand that they are, eventually people will resist this concept, eventually people are going to be upset about what's happening, is that in order to gain total control, he has to rebuild the whole world from the DNA up.
And these doctors, they were all in when it came to the Nazi ideologies. I mean, particularly when it came to the SS. Now, for those of you who don't know, the SS were the most ardent of Hitler's Nazis. They were the true believers who enforced his racial policies in Germany and the occupied countries, in addition to being the fiercest of his soldiers on the battlefield and, worst of all, the ones who ran the concentration camps.
These people are freaking terrifying. Yes. When you watch the footage, they are so scary.
And one of the most surprising things that I learned during our research on this series was that the largest group of professionals within the SS was by far doctors.
Oh, no. Oh, no. This is more anti-doctor talk. It just gets worse and worse. I'm already scared of the doctor, man. I was scared when I went yesterday, and I went to a really nice place in Burbank.
Really? I wonder if your doctor treats Jay Leno.
No.
Maybe he does. You are the same doctor as Jay Leno.
Was there a nice car outside?
Do you know Jay Leno?
No, with Jay Leno's doctor also has to be vintage, so it's his doctor and his barber, and he treats everything by having him drink bourbon.
But years before the rise of the SS came to pass, the Nazis were getting inspired by all the eugenics programs going on in America, and they decided that it was time for them to implement their own version.
Oh, man, why didn't they just, like, try to take our First Amendment, take our Constitution?
How about jazz?
Jazz! Take jazz! Yeah.
In fact, the Nazis often cited a study based on the California sterilization program to justify their own policies. The Rockefellers even helped fund German eugenics programs, including one that employed none other than Joseph Mengele.
We'll get into the Rockefellers one day. We will do the Rockefellers. Yep. Again, I keep promoting this. I promoted it on Side Stories about how last podcast is going to go out on Marcus's and I fucking 25-hour-long Illuminati breakdown.
I will say, if you want to see Rockefeller's grave, it's in Sleepy Hollow, where, of course, the tale of the Headless Horseman is very famous. Beautiful graveyard, old-school tombstones. But outside of Rockefeller, he has this huge, it's a tomb, you know, it's massive. And I'm screaming at it, and I flick it off. And then this group of kids walk by with their parents, and their parents looked at me like I had two heads. And I'm like, he's a criminal! What are you yelling at me for? And then Brooke is like, we gotta go.
You with a fucking Michael Myers shirt on and basketball shorts with two tall boys and either hand screaming, crimes against humanity.
They are crimes against humanity. Now, talk about the federal banking system. I mean, come on.
Now, the Nazis didn't go from zero to Holocaust.
Although, I mean, that is not
terrible,
a measure.
Terrible part of the Fast and Furious franchise.
Although the time frame in which they went from admiring the American eugenics programs to gassing millions was still alarmingly fast. All the Nazis needed to do it the way they wanted to do it was to have the right people in power in all the right places.
Right.
So when the Nazis took control of the government in 1933, they set their sights on the universities. Their first order of business when it came to that was to ban all Jewish people from teaching or working at schools, universities, and state-run hospitals. To give you an idea of the impact of this, at Berlin University alone, that action opened up 42% of the staff positions.
Wow.
So suddenly, all these non-Jewish physicians and soldiers who were out of work, they suddenly had jobs, and it was all due to Nazi policies.
Wow.
All these guys had to do was sell their soul to get those jobs.
It's like fucked up that it's still about job creation. Like
it's
still
about
that.
Job creation.
And they used that in a way that it's like, I mean, the Nazis at this point, did they have like total control at this point in 1933?
1933, Hitler was chancellor. They had complete and total control over everything. Besides small pockets of resistance here and there, people who were doing what they could do, because it's not like the entire town, the entire country of Germany suddenly became Nazis. I mean, that's the old adage, is that the first country that the Nazis occupied was Germany. There were a lot of people in Germany that were not okay with what was
going
on.
Absolutely. And now, for some reason, I just, as a cathartic activity, I need to play Wolfenstein again.
This is what I've been thinking about this whole time. I bought a PS4 literally shipped to my house to get Wolfenstein because nothing makes me fucking thirstier than fucking shooting up a bunch of Nazis.
They're so fun. That's why I couldn't play Call of Duty Modern Warfare. It's about the Iraq War, and I'm like, this is not justified. No. And I'm screaming at the screen, and then I'm like, no, this is a video game. Like, it's not a justified war, sir.
No, dude, I'm gonna be fucking, you're right, I'm gonna be playing some fucking Wolfenstein this week.
One of the best games ever.
It's gonna be so
all
cool.
Three of them.
Yeah, all three of them are fucking great. But on the other hand, there were quite a few of these doctors who already had a belief in anti-Semitic eugenics when they stepped into the jobs vacated by the Jewish men and women who were pushed out. Hmm. One of those, of course, was Josef Mengele. He was an ardent believer in the, quote, lives unworthy of living belief that was gaining power.
Jeez.
This is that term is big.
Huge.
Early Nazi thought. The lives unworthy of living, and another term that haunts me, which is the term useless eaters.
Mm.
Useless eaters? I didn't hear that before.
It is, yeah, that is a very real Nazi term. It's bone chilling.
Oh, God.
This belief, pushed by Dr. Ernst Rudin, whose lectures Mengele regularly attended, was that doctors should be in charge of destroying what they called life devoid of value, starting with sterilization. Among those who were offered up for this program were schizophrenics, epileptics, the hereditarily blind and deaf, the physically deformed, manic depressives, and alcoholics, meaning all three of us here. All of us getting sterilized.
Which Jesus one am Christ. I?
Alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. Alcoholic.
I'm a Wisconsinite.
You two guys get sterilized for alcoholism. I get sterilized for manic depressiveness.
What? Well, if you had beer, you won't be manic depressive.
According to science, I've counted my drinks and I looked at it. I am a moderate drinker.
I'm a moderate drinker for my size and my region.
You know what? Also, because they're regularly going to lectures where people like Ernst Rudin are doing these speeches where they're showing footage of cancer cells being destroyed by antibodies. And basically, they were like, with the antibodies, they would have little, like, swastikas on them. And then the cancer cells would be labeled Jews. So, like, they had already, this thing was, like, so deep inside. And so it starts with a slow rollout of being like, we're going to do these people that are very sick and hard, quote-unquote, hard on society. The deformed, the people born handicapped. And we're going to get rid of them first in order to cleanse the bloodline.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And they actually had full schools dedicated to this stuff. They had these isolated schools that they would send all of the doctors and nurses and everybody. They would send them out to these isolated places and they would teach eugenics there. And the chilling thing about that is that they would release a journal every single year about what they talked about, what they were doing. Until 1937. And then starting in 1937, they didn't tell anybody what they talked about. All they did was say, we had a conference here. They would not say anything because that was when they were really starting to do the horrible shit.
And of course, they also made a lot of money off of Super Beats infomercials. Evidently, I don't know if you know this, Henry, beets are the world's greatest food.
Superfood.
Superfood.
Wait, so as long as they don't start calling it the Uber food, then we're fine.
Now, it was a very short jump from the sterilization of these types of people to their full-on murder, what Robert J. Lifton calls the Nazification of medicine. See, the goalpost of the Hippocratic Oath, i.e. do no harm, all doctors take it, goalpost got moved by the Nazis. It was no longer a concept of one-on-one healing between a doctor and patient. It was now an oath that applied to the bigger picture, the greater good, with one doctor describing it as cutting out the festering appendix of the world.
So do therapists take that oath too?
The Hippocratic Oath? I don't think so. I think psychologists do. The ones that give you medicine, they take
it. Oh, I'm going to a psychologist.
Oh, yeah, he takes it.
Well,
he called me fat.
He's technically trying to help you.
Did he call you fat or did he?
Called me fat.
Did he say, Ben Kissel, you are a fat, fat boy?
He said, Ben, I don't know how else to say this. You're fat. No, he said I was overweight. He used the word overweight.
Okay.
He tried to criticize Puffin.
No, he was doing the Dr. Phil.
Everywhere.
He was doing the Dr. Phil tough love. That's all that was. Technically, that is what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
Well, I think I'm going to tell him he just violated the Hippocratic Oath.
Oh, man.
I am.
Yes, fucking yes. This is going to be rough.
He's going to get a
next session, man.
He's going to get an email from me. I promise you that.
Well, in the middle of all this shit, Josef Mengele was rising in the ranks. He had become a full Nazi in 1937, and that same year, he joined the Third Reich Institute for Hereditary Biology and Racial Purity at the University of Frankfurt.
Oh, I think it speaks a lot that in this changing temperament, that's when he's crushing it.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
There's something about how, like, there are time periods for specific people. and Mengele saw the gap for himself. Like, he saw this spot being like, I fit in perfectly right there. And it's like, that's not a good place to be.
No, that's not
a good space. Me, it's like, I see myself, 1920s jazz period in America, having fun. Having an absinthe cocktail, fancy hat on. Also, I like the Dada period of France where people are like doing weird sketch comedy with like dick masks on and stuff. That's fun.
I cannot imagine Third Reich, that's literally called Third Reich University.
Third Reich Institute for Hereditary Biology and Racial Purity. That was where Mengele would meet the man who would change the course of both his life and the lives of thousands of others. That was where Mengele met Professor Otmar Freiherr von Verschuer. Professor Otmar Freiherr von Verschuer was a huge supporter of Hitler, praising him as being, quote, the first statesman to recognize hereditary biological and race hygiene. And his way of contributing to the cause was through the research of twins. The thought was that by studying the phenomenon of twins, one could unlock the secrets of birth and hereditary function, and the creation of the master race would therefore be easier and more fruitful.
Now, didn't he also, wasn't he also obsessed with twins because you had a built-in control group? It seems it's almost out of weird, like, weird scientific laziness, where what's great about especially identical twins for them is that they have the same sets of stuff and it's supposed to be vaguely identical, so you can experiment on one and then have a control one to compare it to at all times.
Yep,
that was part of it, but a lot of it was them trying to unlock the secret of twins, like they were
trying, and having many of them
quite a few of them.
And it is impossible for one twin to be strong and muscular and the other twin to be Danny DeVito. It's an inaccurate film, that's for sure. But if you want to see a great twins movie, Risky Business.
That's a good one,
That's a great one. It is. They're going to strip mine Jupiter Holland.
I want to put all of the references of this show, of like all of the books, and then just Risky Business. Like, that's pretty much essential viewing for this episode.
It is.
Now, it cannot be understated how important the research of Professor Otmar Freiherr von Verschuer was when it came to influencing Mengele. In fact, it could be said that Mengele, once he was in Auschwitz, was Professor Otmar Freiherr von Verschuer's proxy. Mm. It isn't an overstatement to say that the place where these two met was the absolute epicenter of Nazi scientific thinking. This was the orchard where the bitter fruit of the human experiments done in concentration camps was grown. This is where it all came from.
But to them, they're acting like they're fucking Steve Jobs and fucking Wozniak in a garage, and it was this incredible place of inspiration that they get they get all of this freedom. They get to sit here and they get to talk about these ideas that before they had to hide from the world because people didn't understand them, and now they finally can openly discuss what they've been talking about in private for many years.
Mm-hmm. Right. So was Mengele at this point, was he like a really good student?
Yeah. I mean, they said he was pretty good. Like, he wasn't extraordinary, but he had good grades. He was about, I think at this time, like 26, 27, somewhere around there.
He was just highly ambitious.
Yes.
And he knew what he had to do. As soon as he saw the track of where you put yourself to be on top of the Nazi party. Like, he wanted to be famous. This whole thing is about, he's fucking Cardi B.
Right.
It wasn't just fame that he wanted. He wanted notoriety. He wanted, because Cardi B's not going to be in the encyclopedia, but Josef Mengele is.
So don't speak so soon. We could have a congresswoman Cardi B at some point.
Who knows?
I saw that video that she did. She is very passionate.
Yeah, she's definitely screaming at a camera. I love it. So it's literally like going back to Animal House. It's like if the whole movie was from the side of Needlemeyer, and then you're against the boys in the Animal House.
Pretty much, yeah. Yep. And Mengele, the whole time he was there, he was taken in every bit of it. One historian said that Mengele at this time became the incarnation of Nazism in its extreme. But that status was almost never reached, as Mengele's own personal tastes came into question in 1939. That was the year that he met and married his wife, Irene. So by this time, marriage had become quite the stringent process in Germany, particularly amongst members of the SS. In the 2 years since Mengele had joined the Nazi Party, he'd not only become a full SS member, but he had made it to the elite, the Waffen-SS.
The Waffen-SS?
Yeah, the Waffen-SS, they were the armed leg of the SS. They are the ones that had the guns, and also they loved sweet breakfasts.
Oh, yeah, it sounds like it. I don't quite see the attraction here of Irene. I don't know why Irene would like Joseph.
I don't know. And of course, when Josef joined the SS, that came with racial purity tests, which Mengele passed, but his wife was a different story. When they married, Mengele was required to submit Irene's family history to the Central Office for Race and Resettlement to ensure that there was no trace of Jewish blood in her family.
The titles of these bureaucratic institutions are bone-chilling.
Yeah.
They're so
horrible.
The
Central Office of Race and Resettlement? Can you imagine getting a letter from the Central Office for Race and Resettlement?
They use this. This is what they used in order to sound official. It's what Scientology does. It's what any fucking
I was thinking
cult
Scientology
does.
Too, yeah.
It's what any cult does, is they put a fucking fancy name on it in order for it to sound legit. Because the part of it, this all came from the Nuremberg laws. This shit had been certain getting baked in. And it was fucking intense. Like, you had to go through each one. And it had a whole, we're going to see this when we go through Auschwitz too. The way that they do the organizational part of Auschwitz and all the number crunching and all the fucking, like, essentially Excel sheets
right. That
are hundreds of thousands and millions of people dying, but the way they organize it, they put it in this way that be like, oh, you see, it's completely legit because
right. It's
a graph, because it's got a bunch of, like, numbers and shit on it, and it looks official.
Yeah, it's the medicalization of it all. It's the organization of it all. There is a reason why they went from just shooting people and throwing them in a ditch to the full medicalized or quote-unquote medicalized process. The way they justified it is medicalized mm-hmm. in the concentration camps.
Mm-hmm. And then you have to go and you have to present your papers, and it's literally a person going like, okay, let's look at your grandfather. Okay, his favorite condiment was mayonnaise, so yes, he is Aryan. And since your great-grandfather on your mother's side, his favorite instrument was the clarinet. I don't know that could go any way. Let's take a look at some of these pictures. Cargo shorts. He is of the Aryan race. Congratulations. Welcome to the SS.
All the mayonnaise you can eat.
I mean, the hitch that Irene ran into was that there were no papers attached to her great-grandfather, who was an American diplomat named Harry Lyons Dumler. And since there was no proof that he was her great-grandfather, she just said, like, yeah, my great-grandfather, he was an American diplomat. That's all we know about him.
Right.
The Nazis assumed, he's probably Jewish, right? You're lying about this, right? So since we don't know, it was like, if you didn't know, they couldn't believe that someone wouldn't know who their great-grandfather was.
Her great-grandfather?
Yeah, so like, we can't believe you wouldn't know that, so you're probably hiding something from us. You're probably hiding the fact that he's Jewish. But after...
Talk about bureaucratic on top of bureaucratic.
Yeah.
It is that shit. It's
deadly.
It's papers, all your fucking bullshit.
Crazy.
Deadly bureaucracy. That's what this is. This is life or death bureaucracy. But after showing photographs of her and her ancestors, plus having friends testify to her quote-unquote very Nordic ways, the Nazis finally approved.
I love thrash metal.
Look, you see, I, there's no way I'm not Nordic. I came in skis. I do not even wear shoes. My favorite flower is the cabbage.
But since they were not able to prove that she had pure Aryan blood by their standards, the Mengele family was left out of the Sippin book.
They weren't in the Sippin book, huh?
No, nope.
Now, what is that, like a song?
Yeah, but honestly,
what is
the
that?
Sippin book was like, that was a get, man. That was a big get for Nazis.
Yeah.
What the hell is the Sippin book?
The Sippin book was essentially a catalog of all the quote-unquote racially clean SS families.
So there's just pictures of them?
And it's just like, this person is in the Sippin. Heinrich Himmler's in the Sippin book.
You want to be in the Sippin book,
you wanna,
I guess.
Well, if you
want to get in there.
If you're not in the Sippin book, you don't get the Sippin book merch.
This is all about fucking merch. These goddamn nerds and their merch.
There was so much. Don't you dare rail against merch, because we have the Detective Popcorn plushie that's still available for sale in our live show. Our live taping of our live show in Chicago is only $6.66.
www.lastpodcastlive.com. But that is incredible.
Yeah, they had Sippin Book merch. The Sippin Book merch is that every time a pure child was born, Heinrich Himmler would send you some swords and some silver spoons.
Yeah, dude. But you'd get them from Himmler. You'd get them from the guy.
Yeah, the guy, oh, the architect of the Holocaust. That's who you got this from. Yeah.
That's so they're all part of the club.
They're all a part of the club,
wow.
Yeah. But at the same time that Mengele was trying to prove his wife's racial purity, the mass murder had already begun. And the very first person who had been killed in Nazi Germany as a part of these programs was an infant born to an SS couple. This child had been born at home without arms or legs. So when the child was born, the SS father immediately took the baby, dropped it off at the Leipzig clinic, and told him that under no circumstances would the family take it back. They just forgot about it. Just like, just take it. I don't care.
Yep, because the wife screamed.
She screamed.
When they pulled the baby out, she screamed, get this out of here. Mm. And then the husband took it to the hospital, and he said, we're not taking this.
Yeah.
You need to take this. Like, it's a like he bought a fucking set of headphones that didn't work.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
While Hitler did not give the original order to kill the child, he told the doctor in charge of the program, whatever happens to the baby, it's not going to be brought in front of the courts, so do whatever you want.
So he just gave permission.
And yeah. So, and that's how it began. It all began with that one baby. So over the next few years, a program began in which somewhere between 80 and 100,000 disabled persons and mental patients were murdered by the Nazis. It all began with oral poisons and lethal injections, but as the victims became more numerous, the killing needed to be streamlined. And this was how the Nazi gas chambers came into being with the mental patients and the disabled people.
If you want to really creep yourself out, watch some of the propaganda videos at the time selling this to the German people.
Yeah.
And it shows pictures of being like, because the way they put it at this point was this kind of sympathetic angle of, look at these people, they will never live a whole lives, and would show people of various level of handicap. And it's like, we want the German people to be happy and healthy. And it shows just like smiling blonde girls zig-heiling, throwing medicine balls back and forth. Or like, and like a 9-year-old boy drinking a beer. He's like good, healthy SS child. And they're all these doing like calisthenics in a field. Like, that's what you want.
Right.
All these able-bodied dudes that all technically look like Captain America.
See, the gas chambers, they didn't originate in the concentration camps. That was just where they were perfected. Originally, the gas chambers were built in 6 isolated mental hospitals around Germany, and the patients would be killed en masse using carbon monoxide. Mm. Then a letter would be sent to the family with a false cause of death. They're like, yeah, just make up whatever you want. Just tell them they died from appendicitis. But the thing is that a lot of people were noticing, like, he died of appendicitis. He had an appendectomy when he was 10. There's no way he could have died of appendicitis. But a lot of people were like, oh, okay, so he's dead now? All right,
so
whatever.
So the families didn't know
they were sending their children to die? They did not. No, they were just like, oh, they died. I'm sorry.
This is my question, and this is going to come up again in Auschwitz too. And I feel like it's the contradictory nature of the fascist mind. I don't know how this is. Obviously, I'm not a fucking anthropologist or a historian, so I don't fucking know. But I think it's interesting the fact that they went to all of these pains to validate their views, right? They went to all of these pains to say that science is the reason why, and later on we have all these breakdowns of why we're doing this. It's all completely backed up. But then they do shit like this where they lie to the people about the cause of death. Where just, and the same thing when they covered up for after Auschwitz, and when they do all this, so we'll get into that in detail in the second episode, but it's like, why aren't you just proud of it? You are doing your duty to Germany. Mm. Why don't you just say the full facts of what went down instead of lying about it and hiding? You're secretly ashamed of what you're doing, and you don't want them to know, and you're doing all of these distancing things.
You know, what it could be is, I mean, Holly, it kind of makes me think of something that you said, Darren. I think the Peter Curtin episode's talking about, like, the mind of a psychopath, and this is like a psychopathic society, you know, talking about Peter Curtin, how he was dealing with his wife, and talking about, like, when he confessed to her, like, his thought was, you're not going to be a fucking bummer about this, right? And that's what it is that it's not that they think they're wrong. It's like, these people are going to be mental patients. Like, they're going to they're fucking psychopaths because they don't think about it. They're like, everyone's going to be upset about it, so we'd better keep it a secret from
it
them.
It also kind of cleanses the guilt of the parents.
Yeah,
somewhat, you know, because then maybe they can say, "Oh no, it was natural causes or something."
They had a preternatural understanding of how to keep people psychologically in line.
Yeah. Now, amidst all this horror, it must be said that there was a resistance. There was quite a few resistance groups all over Germany, and the resistance group that was in the medical community was the White Rose.
Ooh.
Yeah, there were a bunch of students at the University of Munich, and they would distribute leaflets and do graffiti denouncing these practices and calling for the overthrow of Hitler. Now, although, shit, like, you know, distributing leaflets and doing graffiti, it doesn't sound like a whole bunch, but these people were taking their lives into their own hands.
High stakes.
Like, huge stakes. These were extremely brave people. And as a consequence of their actions, they were rooted out and condemned by a Nazi people's court to death and were beheaded by guillotine. Only one survived. There was a woman survived, managed to make it and keep herself alive in prison until the Allies came and rescued her.
Wow.
But all these people went to their deaths with courage, with one shouting right before the blade came down, Es lebe die Freiheit! Long live freedom.
Hell yeah.
Wow. Okay, brave hero.
Yeah, these people were fucking awesome. Like, the White Rose, I want to get into it, and I would love to do a series on just, like, resistance groups in these oppressed communities, because, like, resistance fighters are among the most badass fucking people in history.
Yeah.
These guys are fucking
dude.
Great. However, this was years after the programs were first put into place. This was 1942. These programs were first put into place in the late 30s. The name given to the euthanasia program after the war was Action T4, named after the street address of the agency that was in charge of making sure these guys got paid.
They had pay stubs doing this shit.
And that's one of the most mind-boggling things about all this. I mean, the guys who were doing all this shit, authorizing it, carrying it out, they were collecting paychecks. And for some reason, I don't know why, but that mundane detail, that's what makes all this shit real for me.
Yeah.
Is that they were collecting paychecks.
Again, it makes it completely real.
It was built into society, and not to steal from Dan Carlin, the fucking carrots and sticks of this whole thing benefited towards the psychopath.
Absolutely.
It made you want to do it. You were ready to join the cause. And Mengele was in the center of all this, and he was fucking killing it. He was making the right friends. He was writing the right reports. There was a part of when you go through, it's like he would kind of... He developed this kind of concept. He wrote a paper on these, because this is also before DNA was discovered, right? So these guys are doing genetics research, but they're doing it like they're fucking butchering a cow.
Right.
But the way they're looking at shit, it's stuff like Mengele wrote a paper about how you can tell the difference between peoples by the folds of their ears in comparison to their chin folds. And I was like, well, some my folds in my chin don't look like my ears, because if they did, I would look like a fucking wrestler, like a college wrestler.
Ooh,
but it's that kind of bullshit. But part of it is this ancient science that they're kind of attached to. And then Mengele would also go for and do these sort of criticize other articles for not saying, like in open papers, he would criticize other articles talking about features of the Aryan race for not at first denoting the fact that the Aryan race was superior to the other races. He kind of like built that into slowly but surely realizing, oh, the political fashionable thing is to make sure you always ping, Aryans are the best though. And here's everything else.
That was always their baseline. And I think that's important to remember. The baseline of all of their research was always like, it's a given that the Aryans are superior. Why are they superior? Because we said so.
Right.
Because look at us. We are obviously superior. So it's like that is the baseline of all Nazi research.
Yeah, just cut to Augustus Gloop knee deep in a chocolate pie.
Oh, I am stuck in the pipe. Oh, someone grab my team. Could someone please grab my feet? I'm stuck in. Too ticklish.
Well, in October of 1939, Hitler signed a note authorizing euthanasia officially. By that time, the German people's attention was focused elsewhere, as a month before, Hitler had invaded Poland, officially kicking off World War II. And this was just 5 weeks after Josef Mengele's wedding. And Mengele wanted to jump right into the action, but it would be a further 2 years before he'd see combat. In 1941, he was sent to Ukraine, where he was awarded the Iron Cross Second Class within days.
Part of his job was he was on the front lines, right? And he was also joined, he was in the Waffen SS, so they went right. The Waffen. He was in the Waffen. And so when he went, they went right into the shit first. Like, they were in Russia. They were deep, deep in Ukraine and Russia fighting real hard. And his job was to go and save people. Like, that's kind of because he was a medic.
He was a medic,
and so what he would do is, but a part of what they talked early on into his army career was that, so like, Mengele always had an eye for who should be left behind and who should live. And you're just like, Jesus Christ. It started even then. Where he'd be like, this guy's too far. Goodbye. You are the weakest link, and then he'd leave.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely horrifying to have that man be the one who is responsible for saving people's lives. It's very ironic.
Yeah. Well, after that, he was shipped to Berlin and worked actively in Heinrich Himmler's Race and Resettlement Office. It was here, in 1942, that Josef Mengele was most likely entrusted with the secret of the final solution. See, even though Hitler had given the order to enact the final solution in the summer of 1941, the concentration camps had been around and in use since the very beginning of Hitler's rise to power in 1933. Overseen by nerdy chicken farmer and SS leader Heinrich Himmler, the concentration camps originally held political prisoners and anyone determined to be a security threat to the Nazi regime.
Himmler can go fuck himself, too.
Well, these places, the concentration camps, they were extra legal, meaning people could be kidnapped and shipped away at any time, completely independent of any judicial review. The men who guarded these camps were part of what was called the Death's Head Unit.
Or, what do they do?
Or, in the original German, Totenkopfverbande.
It is scary.
Yeah.
The fucking skull and crossbones on their fucking hats.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, honestly, what do you think you're fucking signing up for? What do you think you're doing?
It is incredible. The Germans, I mean, I don't know if this is appropriate, but they kind of cosplayed their way into this.
We've talked
about
this. Because they
went full on in, like, their uniforms. They went full in.
I really do think that the uniforms, it's a big joke, you know, that everyone makes is that, like, yeah, you know, the uniforms are so great. The uniforms are absolutely a part of it. The uniforms were a part of the romanticism.
Absolutely.
It was all a part of this entire, like, the romanticism of being in the Aryans. You get this amazing uniform. You get all of this shit. It is very, very romantic.
You got Hugo Boss designing all this stuff.
Yeah.
It's all primo, grade.
It's also the fucking telltale sign of a deeply insecure group of people.
Yes.
Where they had to prop themselves up as being a bully. That's what it is, right? It's a bully's mentality. It's this concept of being like, they can't earn respect by doing things correctly and doing things in a way that helps society. So they want to steal respect by creating fear. And so these puffed up fucking losers get to put on these fucking death caps, get to shroud yourselves in death, and then you get to feel super important because everybody's fucking scared of you. But you also have a backup of millions of other ones just like you. So you act like you're the fucking big bad boy, but it's only because you got a bunch of other shitheads trying to back you up.
And although all SS units wore a skull and crossbones on their caps, the SS Death's Head units set themselves apart by being the only ones authorized to wear the Death's Head symbol on their lapel. So you saw it right as you were looking at these guys. Like, everywhere, at both places that you looked on these guys, if you were looking up or you were looking down, you saw death. And nobody wore that death's head prouder than Dr. Josef Mengele. But before he arrived in the concentration camps, Mengele actually saw a fair bit of action, as he was sent to the Eastern Front as a part of the SS Viking Division fighting the Russians. And it was here that Mengele earned the Iron Cross First Class after rescuing two soldiers from a burning tank under enemy fire, which was a distinction that set him apart from many of the other concentration camp doctors. Mengele was the only guy who had actually seen combat. But of course,
It was also something that Mengele would use to pull rank, only adding to his almost supernatural arrogance, because that's another huge part of Mengele is arrogance. Yeah.
Well, he's totally in control. He knows exactly what he's doing. The image that comes up quite often when I think of Mengele is Tom Brady. Not to attack. He's never killed anyone. I view Mengele as the Tom Brady of Nazis because, I mean, he was nothing but net for a while, man.
Well, Tom Brady plays football, so if he's nothing but net, that's actually bad.
It's the sports. Them. He was doing good, but the idea of being like he quote unquote looked good. He fucking did the shit. He had a little death's head pin. He told everyone, remind you, oof, look at the pin every single time anybody had anything to say to him, because then you know he could get two extra brats on the lunch line when everybody else only got one. He got two.
You're saying it's all about the brats.
I'm just saying.
Is that your professional analysis?
It's like, I'm eating for two. It is for me and Hitler.
Yeah, hell yeah. Big ups, everybody.
I don't like Tom Brady or the Patriots, but comparing him to Mengele is a little too far, Mr. Strauss.
It's a bit extreme.
But it's a part of the idea. Why do people dislike Tom Brady? Because he's got the model girlfriend. He's always winning. He's got the head shaped like one of the statues from Easter Island, which I guess is a thing that people enjoy. With Mengele had it all.
Yeah, right.
As far as a piece of shit Nazi goes, yeah, Mengele did have it all. I mean, this guy was on top of the fucking world. I mean, he was a war hero. He was respected. He was a scientist. Like, he was one of the Nazi elites.
Right.
He was the SS man. I think it was somebody wrote that he was the SS man that Hitler envisioned in Mein Kampf. He was the guy.
But he also was always very, as of course it seems to be, the ones that are extra dirty. As it, like I brought up, he looked like fucking Desi Arnaz. He had brown hair. He had dark eyes.
He looked Slavic.
And he'd always be like, you know, and then I say to my grandfather, you know, and be like, why do I look this way? And he was just like, I don't know. It kind of runs in the family. And I say, you've got a lot of explaining to do.
Right.
No, he was extremely insecure about his looks because he looked very Slavic.
It's interesting because it's a perfect time, perfect place. If you take Sebastian Bach from the 80s, people thought he was sexy.
Yeah.
And then you put him in any other time period, any other decade, and you're like, who the hell is that wiry, weird-looking mother?
No, you could put 1987 Sebastian Bach in 1967. He's still going to do well.
He will pull a lot of bush, dude. Sebastian Bach can be dropped off into the future. Sebastian Bach could be dropped off in the fucking 1800s. Sebastian Bach is going to be poking hole in any decade. I don't think
Sebastian Bach's look has come and gone.
I don't know.
You know who's very time specific? Post Malone. Post Malone is very specific to 2019.
I don't like his music. He's funny on Instagram, though.
Yeah.
Takes pictures.
Well, it was in combat that Mengele was rumored to have suffered a concussion. And some people think that this, combined with combat PTSD, because he was in the Eastern Front. The Eastern Front, go listen to Dan Carlin's Battle of Stalingrad series. It's woo. Eastern Front is some of the most horrific battlefield conditions of all time.
Yeah, these motherfuckers saw some shit.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope that they all fucking died in an oil fire, but these Nazi guys did see some shit.
Yeah. Well, the Nazi guys and the Russians, you know. But, I mean, but both of them were just fucking brutal to each other.
Oh, yeah.
But the head injury, combat PTSD, plus the extreme anti-Semitism and the indoctrination at the University of Frankfurt, all that stuff together was what allowed Mengele to switch off his humanity when the time came, or at least that's what some people think. But Mengele might not have ever even gone to Auschwitz if not for his old friend, Professor Otmar Freiherr von Warschauer. See, by 1943, the war was already 4 years old, and the concentration camps had expanded greatly since the initial invasion of Poland. Also, 2 years earlier, in 1941, public protest in Germany had caused the Nazis to officially shut down the euthanasia programs that had been responsible for gassing tens of thousands of mental patients and disabled people. Unofficially, the Nazis just kept killing them, only now they were doing it with lethal injections or just by starving them to death over a period of weeks or months. They actually increased the cruelty when the public outcry came.
They would starve them to death.
Right.
And then as they were starving them to death, they would study them.
to see the effects of starving to death and what they would do to them. So that is the kind of shit always where they manage to twist their cruelty. That's why the Nazis...
Oh my gosh.
I mean, in a true crime podcast, right? It's like you keep coming out. This is 4 years almost to the day that we did our Nazis and the Occult series. And so I feel like as a true crime, paranormal, fucking all things macabre podcast, we're going to keep coming back to the Nazis every once in a while, every couple of years, because it's almost like you're forced to. Because
right.
You come back to seeing these creatures, they're fucking creatures. They manage to then, they could twist any cruel thing into a deeper cruel thing
right.
by trying to validate it.
You got to remember this stuff so we don't repeat it. There was another thing in a doc that I saw. They would just use the elements.
Yeah.
So also they would just lock them outside in the freezing and they would in the freezing cold, and they would just see how long it takes for hypothermia to eventually kill them. And I mean, and they said that they were going out. I forget what they told them they were going out to do. It was something that was like supposed to be pleasurable or mildly, mm-hmm. Like it was like a lie where they're like, we're going to give you a little like thing to do.
Yeah.
But obviously, oh, it's just brutal.
Yeah. And the most shocking part about all this, about what they were doing, about the T4 programs, all this shit happened in hospitals under the direction and full approval of doctors. So when the time for the final solution came, the infrastructure was already in place.
Oh, it's almost goodness. Like they were kind of secretly planning for it the entire time.
Yeah.
Not that secretly, though, either, right? I mean, everyone, if you were an aware German, I mean,
the mental hospital stuff, that had gone under the radar pretty hard. Eventually, people did find out, but that was in 1941. And by the time people started protesting the mental patients, the killing of the Jews had already begun.
Right. It's funny. It was not funny. But Germany, my grandfather used to always say it's the size of Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so, like, it was strange for them to... I don't know. It would just seem strange that they wouldn't kind of...
That they wouldn't know.
Pick up on the drift, you know?
It comes down to it's either I fuck with this entire system and destroy my entire life,
livelihood. Done, I mean.
Possibly get thrown into a concentration camp myself, or I leave. Some people left.
A lot of people left
to try to get the fuck out.
Right.
And then it became harder and harder as I got later and later. And then the rest of them just kind of did it.
Yeah, they just kind of went along with it, or they lived a life completely separate from it. I mean, you could be a German farmer and just kind of sidestep all of it and just not have it's like those, and even say like, well, that's something that happens in the cities.
Beer growers are out there. You got a whole bunch of people like they've got their own like Humboldt area where you got guys out there just being like, I just make beer, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I sit here, I make beer all day, I don't see anything, I just drink the beer because the beer seems to help me with the sleeping.
Yeah.
And then I go and I make it all in one go.
Because they could say, you know, I'm not really interested in politics.
Right.
Because like, that's what Hitler was. That's what the Nazis were. To a lot of people in Germany, that was politics. I don't follow politics.
Right.
I'm sorry. And then all of a sudden, it's World War II.
Yeah.
I mean, how did your grandfather's Bierstein hat business work at the time period?
It was great. He found a way to get 64 ounces on either side. And it turns out, though, the human neck can't hold it up.
Can't hold
but
weight,
the hat
which is
itself.
Why, but that's why I say nowadays the human neck needs to grow to support the Bierstein helmet.
Yes, absolutely. That was the major flaw.
Yeah. Well, all the guys who had been in charge of murdering the more vulnerable members of society, they were just transferred to the camps. And the infrastructure was just transferred to the camps. And the way of keeping records was just transferred for the camps.
Ugh.
And this was all decided by 15 bureaucrats discussing the final solution over lunch in the Berlin suburb of Wannsee. And so the concentration camps were quickly filled with the Jews and Romani of Europe, among many other smaller subgroups such as gays, lesbians, and resistance fighters from every country the Nazis occupied, including their own.
This is why representation matters.
Yeah.
Like, they just needed to get a couple of people in there, because I guarantee you if there's a Jewish person in there, they would be like, never mind.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll talk about this at dinner.
Well, that was the problem. That's why it had to become all or nothing. The German government, I forget who it was. I want to say it was either Himmler or Hitler himself who said, like, everybody knows von decent Jew, and they always pull the von decent Jew up, and they're like, yeah, it's because they are human beings. It's almost like they're having human thoughts and like human feelings and not treating everybody like they are what they would be called.
Right, exactly.
And with this, when the concentration camps started filling up, suddenly the Nazis had an abundance of what they disgustingly called human material.
Yep.
And it was most likely Otmar Freiherr von Verschuer who persuaded Josef Mengele to accept a position at Auschwitz, all so they could be completely unfettered in their obsessive study of twins. And this was where the human experimentation truly began, and that is where we'll pick back up next time with an extensive tour of the methods and madness of Auschwitz and how Josef Mengele was at the center of it all.
All right,
again,
there it is, Josef Mengele.
This is a heavy hitter trip.
Oh,
this
yeah.
is really a heavy hitter trip in many ways.
Because absolutely.
Mengele really ended up taking the helm at Auschwitz, even though he had bosses. Even people forget that he wasn't like in charge of Auschwitz.
No,
he was a part of the system, but he really his energy in taking over the experimentation of Auschwitz was fucking very scary. And in our series, so don't worry, we're going to be going through next week. It's going to be pretty intense. We're going to be going through Mengele's crimes. But guess what? We're also getting after that. Nazis on the run. Nazi hunting is going to be a fun time because once it segues into Mengele's running from the Nazi hunters, it becomes a fucking action movie.
There is a great documentary. I mean, it's brutal. Mm-hmm. It's called After Hitler. Basically, all of Europe had about 8 years to do whatever they wanted to do, and they took some massive amounts of revenge.
Yeah.
But this is always a good reminder. Be careful what you digest. Be careful how – don't let yourself get so enamored and wrapped up into one certain thing or ideology. Make sure to – diversify.
Yeah.
You know, just sure that you don't let yourself get – caught up in this kind of stuff because it happens. It's human nature.
Yeah, it is.
And it can happen at any time. We always have to be careful.
Hurting other people's hurting yourself always.
Be careful. The human mind, very manipulable.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to always watch it. And everyone can fall into it. It's funny. We talk about Scientology, Children of God, a lot of really smart people, doctors and lawyers. You know, it happens. So be careful out there.
Every cult is filled with people who said it would never happen to me.
Yep. All right, everyone. Well, there it is. Josef Mengele, part one. I hope you enjoyed it. Very informative. And let's see here. What do we have to do? We're going to be announcing some live shows here in the near future, which will be exciting. I don't think we're quite ready to do that yet.
Not quite, but we're almost there.
But we will be announcing some live shows in the very near future, and we cannot wait to see everybody on the road this year.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to watch us during our small hiatus as we wrap up this book, which is going to be badass.
Yeah.
We're getting some illustrations in on a regular basis from from Tom Neely.
Have we talked about our fucking fantastic illustrator at all? Have we talked about Tom Neely?
This dude, Tom Neely, you might know him from, what was it?
Henry and Glenn Forever.
Henry and Glenn Forever. He has been creating some seriously awesome fucking imagery.
I would say some of the images that he has produced are iconic.
Yeah,
this motherfucker's crushing it.
Yes.
It's so good to see his work, man. We're working together beautifully. I can't wait for you guys to see this shit.
It's going
to
be awesome. So once we finish that, once we finish the book, we're back on the road. But until then, go to www.lastpodcastlive.com. Watch our live show from, just a month ago, I guess, in Chicago.
A month or two, yeah.
It's still fresh off, hot off the presses. So that's only $6.66. If there's any time a problem with the website, don't worry about it. We'll get it fixed ASAP.
Always.
So just keep on going back, please.
Asshole. We're trying to fix it.
Yes, it's just us, as always. And let's see. Is there anything... Do we have any other announcements? Oh, thanks everyone to come for who came out to Forbidden Planet.
Yeah.
Oh, I wish I was there.
It was so much fun.
I wanted to be there.
But that was so much fun to see everybody. And pick up our issue of Fangoria if you get a shot. Yeah. It's a cool article.
It's very cool. Yeah, it's Fangoria number 2. We got a cool little story in there. So yeah, pick it up and always support Fangoria. They're cool fucking people. Where everyone who's involved in the reboot is super fucking cool. So yeah. Fangoria is fucking great.
And the cover, I don't think the covers are quite as extreme as they used to be, but the content is still.
Yeah.
So that's
I mean,
all that matters.
Let's give them a shot. We'll see what happens with the next one.
Yeah.
Because I think they'll ramp it up slowly.
I mean,
I miss that. Because I miss hiding my Fangoria.
Yeah. Because
my mom used to get so upset when I had it in the house.
Oh, yeah. Mine too. Every mom got up so upset.
I'm going to say... rightfully so. I don't want... It's weird to be like one of those
10.
Moms who's like, let me read it after you do. Like, this is supposed to be for me. Yeah, I was telling the main editor, because he was also there yesterday at the Forbidden Planet signing, it used to be in all the adult like magazines.
It was in the porno section.
Yeah, it was in the porno section, which is hilarious.
It's so fun how shit changes, man. I mean, honestly, y'all, don't be Nazis today. If you have the opportunity to be a Nazi today, don't.
Don't.
Say no.
Say
no.
No.
Hail Satan.
All right, everyone. Hail yourselves.
Hail game.
Hail me, please.
Magoostalations. Are you sick? Are you coughing?
I'm better.
You coughed it out.